This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Roads have been torn up by hammer and hand. Concrete and tar used to smash windows and security gates. Bricks and chunks of cement litter roads. Fires smolder.
That's Darren Taylor reporting on the riots in South Africa. Details coming up. Also, Nigerian newspapers protest proposed media law. And a UN Rights Council resolution calls for Eritrean troops to leave the Tigray region. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. In South Africa, what began as protests against the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma for contempt of court have become looting and rioting in several cities. Mobs have used pro-Zuma demonstrators as an opportunity to steal whatever they can from stores in several cities, with criminal gangs joining them. The military has been called out to help restore order in some communities. Darren Taylor reports that scores of people have been injured and killed, and more than 800 people arrested so far.
Shortly after President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke to the nation last night and promised a swift end to the violence, VOA witnessed this shootout between looters and the police in central Johannesburg. Parts of cities in the provinces of Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal have been destroyed. Zuma's name long forgotten by people bent on stealing whatever they're able to lay their hands on. Mobs have also attacked private homes, assaulting families. Roads have been torn up by hammer and hand, the concrete and tar used to smash windows and security gates. Bricks and chunks of cement litter roads. Fires smolder, traffic lights and water pipes ripped from the ground. Here in Jabulani Mall in Soweto, police scream, "Move, move," at looters they've arrested. Gunfire rings out. But as in other parts of South Africa, law enforcement's been hopelessly outnumbered by the pillagers. Clothing, plasma TVs, food, furniture, liquor, they've carried it all past powerless police officers.
Are we deliberately pushing South Africa to a failed African state?
Economist Professor Bonke Dumisa links the violence and looting to the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, and Jacob Zuma in one fundamental respect. For decades, South Africans have watched their leaders loot state coffers with impunity. The ANC, says Dumisa, has instilled a culture of criminality in the country. He also says it's an illusion that the violence is driven by poverty and mass youth unemployment.
By banning stores and looting stores, are you really cutting down on that poverty? And when we are saying youth employment, unemployment may be part of this, that is misleading, because we saw some old people being part of the looting. Stop justifying criminality on political grounds.
The leader of the South African Federation of Trade Unions, Zwelinzima Vavi, agrees the current unrest is a reflection of the ANC's failure to govern properly. It swears allegiance to the poor, he says, but its true allegiance is to money.
Thou shalt be allowed to take out billions, if not trillions of rands, through illicit cash outflows. Thou shalt be allowed to dodge their responsibilities to taxes, because if we were to follow them, we may find out that very soon we ourselves as the political leadership are standing in the dock. And thou shalt allow...
Farvey says the ANC has promised much, but delivered little. There's a 43% unemployment rate. Poverty's worse than under apartheid. The education system's broken. Corruption flourishes. People are angry and hopeless. He says the present violence is evidence of a country waiting to go up in flames.
Every of our major metros are surrounded by the ring of fire. Now you needed to just have a spark, and the spark have happened. We can only pray, all of us. This thing doesn't go to each and every working class community in each and every corner of this country, because no police, no army will be big and strong enough to be able to calm that situation down.
This, says Vavi, is South Africa's future unless a lot more people get jobs and escape poverty very soon and are led by a government that doesn't itself loot. For now, the skies over Johannesburg and Durban are filled with police helicopters and smoke. In some areas, desperate community members, some armed, have formed cordons of vehicles around their suburbs to try to keep the mobs out. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
This evening, the South African police minister, Bekisele, said the violence would be contained. At least 30 people have died in the riots and more than 700 arrested. The protests began late last week after former President Jacob Zuma began serving his 15-month sentence for contempt of court. Zuma was sentenced after refusing to testify before a commission of inquiry into allegations he was involved in the theft of millions of rands from state-owned enterprises. Zuma and his supporters say he is innocent and the inquiry and prison sentence are political persecution. The United Nations Human Rights Council has approved a resolution presented by the European Union calling for an immediate end to all rights violations in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The resolution also demands that Eritrean troops quickly withdraw in a verifiable manner. The French news agency AFP says the resolution highlighted serious abuses in Tigray by Eritrean troops. For months, Ethiopia and Eritrea denied the involvement of Eritrean forces in the conflict, but Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed admitted their presence in March and said they would withdraw. In more news from the region, Tigray Defense Forces today said they had captured the town of Alamata, AFP reported. The offensive to take Alamata comes days after final election results showed Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed winning last month's national election and weeks after Ethiopian federal troops left Tigray. Also on Monday, a U.S. State Department official said Washington is gravely concerned about the reports of continued fighting and reports of continued attacks against civilians. Former Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan founded a political party ahead of national elections planned for December. He stressed that his concern is to meet the aspirations of the youth of Libya who need infrastructure, job opportunities, housing, health, and economic growth. At a gathering last month in Berlin, Libya's regional neighbors and international backers called for the Libyan authorities to do their part to make the elections possible. Wolfgang Porstai, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi the challenges to holding a vote.
ANSMIL will most probably continue to try to find a compromise even by postponing the elections initially for a couple of months. If they reach an agreement to hold the elections, this would be certainly the best way forward. Although much would depend on the voter turnout and the amount of the elections. Let me explain. For the time being, less than 2.4 million Libyans registered so far for the elections. That's just about 48% of those in the voting age. Last week, just about 12,500 registered. And the registration period ends in less than 3 weeks. If the figure remains that low, the acceptance of the outcome of eventual elections will be again, like 2014, very limited. Especially as we can see the voter turnout of the current second round of local elections is just about 22%. This would mean all over Libya, just 500,000 of Libyans would vote. One could really ask, how much interest do the Libyans really have to decide themselves about their destiny? If there are no elections until, let's say, next summer for whatever reason, the GNU would increasingly lose its credibility as it was appointed just to cover the brief period to the elections. There are already some minor protests against Abebe in the east and in the south because he can't fulfill his promises in the eye of the protesters. Those protests will certainly become more and more over time. But one also must not forget that the legitimacy of the House of Representatives rests just with the June 2014 elections. There were 630,000 voters that time, and the High Council of State has no democratic legitimacy at all. So all this would certainly lead to increased tensions and eventually also to a new major outbreak of violence.
Is it logical to have elections in Libya before re-establishing the state and institutions?
I would say there is no real other choice than to have elections as soon as possible, preferably by the end of the year. But it would be absolutely necessary that the international community pressures and pushes the Libyans to sign up for the elections. It would be necessary to ensure that much more than just 50% of the people in the voting age sign up. And it would be necessary to urge much more than 20% of the voters to really use their votes on the voting day. And this would mean that the international community needs to take care and needs to ensure also security on the voting days, and also needs to ensure to limit election fraud by international observers, and I would say also by remote cameras to observe the election offices themselves.
That was Wolfgang Pashtai, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with my colleague Mohamed Al-Shanawi. Nigerian newspapers are protesting legislation being considered in parliament that would allow authorities to control the press. All Nigeria's national dailies on Monday had information blackout boldly printed on their front pages to raise support against the proposal. Timothy Obiezu reports from the capital, Abuja.
The agreement to stage a front-page protest was reached last week during a meeting of the Nigerian Press Organization, NPO, in Lagos. The solidarity will continue Tuesday and Wednesday with the aim of raising awareness and mobilizing public support against the bills which would give greater powers to two regulatory bodies, the Nigerian Press Council and the Nigerian Broadcasting Commission. Lawmakers say the bills are intended to curb fake news, but critics say the bills would give authorities the power to hit media outlets and journalists with huge fines and give journalists up to 3 years in jail. Nigerian activist and freelance writer Raphael Adebayo welcomes the daily's protests and say the media bill is an attack on free speech.
It is a laudable step to take that the Media Guild in the country have realized the saliency of solidarity against the common enemy that faces press freedom in Nigeria today.
The Nigerian lawmaker who initiated the bills, Olusegun Odebumi, said the changes are not an attempt to gag the media. Debates on the bill began amid the government's move to tighten regulations on social media. Last month, the government suspended Twitter in Nigeria for censoring a comment by President Muhammadu Buhari. Authorities are yet to reverse this ban. Authorities also say falsehoods promoted on such platforms could trigger violence. The director of news at Voice of Nigeria, Ahaziah Abubakar, says the government's concerns are valid. But Adebayo says the government is simply trying to stifle opinions that are contrary to theirs.
There is already in existence a reviewed NBC code, which continues to make life harder for people who are working in the press. Yet, they want to make it even harder to express themselves, to express the opinion of the people, and to express generally the state of things in the country.
Media sanctions have become more frequently discussed since Buhari was first elected in 2015. Between 2017 and 2019, lawmakers considered a bill to regulate social media and another bill proposing the death penalty for anyone promoting hate speech about the government. Both bills were suspended after public outcries. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The emir of Kajuru, Alhassan Adamu, who was kidnapped in Nigeria's Kaduna state, has been freed. The French news agency AFP reports the emir's palace was stormed by attackers early Sunday. They also seized members of the emir's family, and 13 of them remain in captivity. The emir's eldest son said he was released late yesterday and is now in his palace. Emirs are revered in predominantly Muslim northern Nigeria as custodians of Islam and tradition. Kaduna State has become a target for kidnapping for ransom gangs, seizing students and travelers on highways. The abduction of the emir marked the first time such a high-profile victim has been seized. Gambia's Electoral Commission has finished its registration drive. About 1 million voters have been enrolled to take part in the country's upcoming December 4th presidential elections. Reporter Panderambai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The Independent Electoral Commission, or IEC, concluded its voter registration exercise last Sunday amid weeks of crisscrossing the country. Aliu Mamarinjai is the chairman of Gambia's Election Commission.
Well, it ended up yesterday. After 41 days, day and night, working throughout. So the exercise now is completed, and they are now bringing all the reports, the data, the machines and everything, so that we know exactly how many people we are registered. But as far as we are concerned, we feel we are on target. So 31 million people we had projected to register.
However, the Gambian diaspora, said to be totaling about 200,000 people, has been excluded from the voter registration drive. The IEC chairman tells VOA that in order for those living abroad to be able to vote, current laws must be changed.
In the constitution, there are 53 constituencies, and the diaspora issue must be addressed by the lawmakers to increase the constituencies by 5. Because we have 5 constituencies in the diaspora. And until that is done, you cannot register them. That's the problem. We are engaging the National Assembly to change the act so that when they change the act, we can go and register them for them to vote. And you voted in parliament as well.
But Gambian political human rights activist Pas Sambajau disagrees.
That argument is flawed. This idea that they have to amend the constitution is nothing but an excuse. There is nothing, no legal impediment to the diaspora registration and voting. The only thing that IEC is doing is playing with our rights based on their convenience.
The Supreme Court recently came down in favor of Jau and 4 others after it ruled that Gambians in the diaspora have the right to be registered and to run for public office. But the government has not enforced the court ruling, according to Jagan Gray Johnson, one of the plaintiffs of the lawsuit.
The mere test on the credibility of our judiciary and the rule of law is on the line. You can't have a judgment that's been made by the highest court of the land only to be ignored and to be looked upon with contempt, whereby the enforceability now remains in question. If we get to that stage in this new Gambia, whereby the Supreme Court of the land could be ignored at will and with great impunity, it doesn't tell well for the future of the rule of law.
Johnson and his colleagues have filed another court action before the High Court in Banjul, asking that it compel the government and the IEC to implement the Supreme Court ruling. Over 18 political parties have so far been registered to take part in the upcoming elections. The IEC chairman says he is currently reviewing 3 more applicants who have submitted their paperwork to set up a political party. This would be Gambia's first post-transition election since the fall of dictator Yahya Jammeh about 5 years ago. Jammeh has been living in exile in Equatorial Guinea since January of 2017. He lost the December 2016 polls to President Adama Barrow. For VOA News, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
A human rights lawyer appointed by the United Nations Human Rights Council has reported that the war-torn Central African Republic's civilian population is being battered by both armed groups and security forces meant to protect it. We have Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva.
The Central African Republic has been in turmoil since rebels overthrew the government in 2013, displacing 1.2 million people. Togolese human rights lawyer Yao Agbetse was appointed by the UN Council in 2019 to monitor and report on the human rights situation in the CAR. He says the Coalition of Patriots for Change, a coalition of major rebel groups, has intensified its attacks against the civilian population since March. He accuses the CPC of recruiting child soldiers, committing sexual violence and murders, illegal taxation, destruction and looting of property, and occupation of schools. He says action is being taken to hold them to account. He speaks through an interpreter.
Most of the leaders and members of the CPC are on the list of sanctions from the Security Council concerning the CAR. The Security Council and the international community as a whole has taken the appropriate steps to ensure that these individuals can be held accountable to violations of human rights and international humanitarian law.
Agbetse says CAR security forces and foreign allies have managed to drive the armed groups out of many areas they have occupied. However, he says many human rights violations allegedly were committed during those operations by members of the military and security personnel, including Russian instructors. He speaks through an interpreter.
The Central African authorities must pursue appropriate investigations regardless of the grade or the military rank of the perpetrators, and attention should be particularly given to victims of these violations. Military justice needs to be triggered in order to provide military justice in the Central African Republic.
The UN expert adds investigations into alleged sexual abuse by UN peacekeepers also must be investigated and sanctioned. CAR Minister of Human Rights and Justice Arnaud Djoubaï Abazene, speaking in response to the report, says he agrees the persistence of human rights violations committed by armed groups remains worrying. He says it is crucial for human rights violators to be brought to justice. That, he says, justifies the need for his government to pursue efforts to tackle impunity and to get the country's system of transitional justice up and running. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiji Suhin in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Paro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.